The girls turned away from Troblum and the cart that had followed him in, chattering brightly among themselves. He looked down at the cylinder as it turned transparent. Inside, it contained a strut of metal 115 centimetres long. At one end, there was a node of plastic where the frayed ends of fibre-optic cable stuck out like a straggly tail. The surface was tarnished and pocked. It was also kinked in the middle, as if something had struck it. Troblum unlocked the end of the cylinder, ignoring the hiss of gas as the protective argon spilled out. There was nothing he could do to stop his hands from trembling as he slid the strut out, nor was there anything to be done about his throat muscles tightening. Then he was holding the strut up, actually witnessing the texture of its worn surface against his skin. He smiled down on it, the way a natural man would regard his newborn child. Subcutaneous sensors, enriching his fingers, combined with his higher field scan function to run a detailed analysis. The strut was an aluminium-titanium alloy with a specific hydrocarbon chain reinforcement. It was also 2,400 years old. He was holding in his own hands a piece of the Marie Celeste, the Starflyer's ship. After a long moment, he put the strut back into the cylinder and ran the atmospheric purge, resealing it in argon. He would never hold it physically again. It was too precious for that. It would go into the other apartment, where he kept his collection of memorabilia. A small stabilizer field generator would maintain its molecular structure down the centuries, as was fitting. Troblum acknowledged the authenticity of the strut and authorized his quasi-legal bank account on Wessex to pay the final installment to the black market supplier on Far Away, who had acquired the item for him. It wasn't that having cash funds was illegal for a hire. Hire culture was based on the tenet of individuals being mature and intelligent enough to accept responsibility for themselves and to act within the agreed parameters of societal norms. "I am government," was the culture's fundamental political kernel. However, quiet methods of converting a higher citizen's energy and mass allocation, EMA, the so-called central dollar, to actual hard cash acceptable on the external worlds were well established for those who felt they needed such an option. EMA didn't qualify as money in the traditional sense. It was simply a way of regulating higher citizen activity, preventing excessive or unreasonable demands being placed on communal resources, of whatever nature, by an individual. As the cart headed back out of the apartment, Troblum hurried to his bedroom. He barely had time to shower and put on a toga suit before he had to leave. The glass elevator took him down to the basement garage where his regrav capsule was parked. It was an old model, dating back 2 centuries, a worn chrome purple in colour and longer than modern versions, with the forward bodywork stretching out like the nose cone of some external world aircraft. He clambered in, taking up over half of a front bench that was designed to hold 3 people. The capsule glided out of the garage and tipped up to join the traffic stream overhead. The centre of Daroka was a pleasing blend of modern structures with their smooth pinnacle geometries, pretty or substantial historical buildings like Troblum's, and the original ample mosaic of parkland that the Founding Council had laid out. Airborne traffic streams broadly followed the pattern of ancient thoroughfares. Troblum's capsule flew northward under the planet's bronze sunlight, heading out over the newer districts where the buildings were spaced farther apart and big individual houses were in the majority. Low in the western sky, he could just make out the bright star that was Air. It was the project that had attracted him to Arevalo in the first place, an attempt to construct an artificial space habitat the size of a gas giant planet. After 2 centuries of effort, the project governors had built nearly 80% of the spherical geodesic lattice that would act as both the conductor and the generator of a single encapsulating force field. Once it was powered up, siphoning energy directly from the star via a zero-width wormhole, the interior would be filled with a standard oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere harvested from the system's outer moons and gas giants. After that, Various biological components, both animal and botanical, would be introduced, floating around inside to establish a biosphere life cycle. The end result? A zero-G environment with a diameter greater than that of Saturn would give people the ultimate freedom to fly free, adding an extraordinary new dimension to the whole human experience. Critics, of whom there were many, claimed it was a poor and pointless copy of the sylphan motherholm that Ozzy had discovered, an entire star wrapped by a breathable atmosphere. Proponents argued that it was just a stepping stone, an important, inspiring testament that would expand the ability and outlook of higher culture. Their rationale won them a hard-fought Central Worlds referendum to obtain the EMAs they needed to complete the project. Troblum, who was first and foremost a physicist, had been attracted to air by just that rationalization. He had spent a constructive 70 years working to translate theoretical concepts into physical reality, helping to build the force field generators that studded the geodesic lattice. At that point, his preoccupation with the Starflyer War had taken over, and he had gained the attention of people running an altogether more interesting construction project. They made him an offer he couldn't refuse. It often comforted him how that episode of his life mirrored one from the life of his illustrious ancestor, Mark. His capsule descended into the compound of the Commonwealth Navy Office. It consisted of a spaceport field lined by two rows of big hangars and maintenance bays. Arevalo was primarily a base for the Navy's Exploration Division. The starships sitting on the field were either long-range research vessels or more standard passenger craft. The three matte-black towers looming along the northern perimeter housed the astrophysics laboratories and scientific crew training facilities. Troblum's capsule drifted through the splayed arches on which the main tower stood and landed directly underneath it. He walked over to the base of the nearest arch column, toga suit surrounding him in a garish ultraviolet aurora. There were not many people about, a few officers on their way to regrav capsules. His appearance drew glances, for a hire to be so big was very unusual. Bionics usually kept a body trim and healthy. It was their primary function. There were a few cases in which a slightly unusual biochemical makeup presented operational difficulties for bionics, but that normally was remedied by a small chromosome modification. Troblum refused to consider it. He was what he was, and did not see the need to apologize for it to anyone in any fashion. Even the short distance from the capsule to the column made his heart race. He was sweating when he went into the empty vestibule at the base of the column. Deep sensors scanned him, and he put his hand on a tester globe, allowing the security system to confirm his DNA. One of the elevators opened. It descended for an unnerving amount of time. The heavily shielded conference room reserved for his presentation was unremarkable, an oval chamber with an oval rockwood table in the middle, 10 pearl-white shaper chairs with high backs arranged around it. Troblum took the one opposite the door and started running checks with the Navy Office net to make sure all the files he needed were loaded properly. Four Navy officers walked in, three of them in identical toga suits, whose ebony surface effect rippled in subdued patterns. Their seniority was evidenced only by small red dots glowing on their shoulders. He recognized all of them without having to reference their U-shadows. Michaela, a third-level captain and the local faster-than-light FTL Drive Bureau director. Johan, a captain who specialized in alien activities. And Yehudi, the Arevalo office commander. Accompanying them was First Admiral Casimir Bernelli. Troblum had not been expecting him. The shock of seeing the commander of the Commonwealth Navy in person made him stand up quickly. It wasn't just his position that was fascinating. The Admiral was the child of two very important figures from the Starflyer War, and famous for a man his age, 1,206 years old. 7 or 8 centuries past the time most hires downloaded themselves into ANA. The Admiral wore a black uniform of stylishly cut old-fashioned cloth. It suited him perfectly, emphasizing broad shoulders and a lean torso, the classic authority figure. He was tall, with olive skin and a handsome face. Troblum recognized some of his father's characteristics, the blunt jaw and jet-black hair. But his mother's finer features were there also, a nose that was almost dainty and pale, friendly eyes. "Admiral!" Troblum exclaimed. "Pleased to meet you." Casimir Bernelli extended a hand. It took Troblum a moment before he realized what to do and put out his own hand to shake, suddenly very pleased that his toga suit had a cooling web and that he no longer was sweating. The social formality file his U-Shadow had pushed into his exovision was withdrawn abruptly. "I'll be representing ANA Governance for this presentation," Casimir said. Troblum had guessed as much. Casimir Bernelli was the essential human link in the chain between ANA Governance and the ships of the Navy Deterrent Fleet, a position of trust and responsibility he had held for over 800 years. Something in the way he carried himself was indicative of all those centuries he had lived, an aura of weariness that anyone in his presence couldn't help being aware of. There were so many things Troblum was desperate to ask, starting with, "Have you stayed in your body so long because your father's life was so short? And possibly, can you get me access to your grandfather?" But instead he meekly said, "Thank you for coming, Admiral." Another privacy shield came on around the chamber, and the net confirmed that they were Grade 1 secure. "So, what have you got for us?" the Admiral said. "A theory on the Dyson pair generators," Troblum said. He activated the chamber's web node so that the others could share the data and projections in his files and began to explain. The Dyson pair were stars 3 light-years apart that were confined within giant force fields. The barriers had been established in AD 1200 by the Anomine, for good reason, to contain the prime aliens, who already had spread from their homeworld around Alpha to Beta, and were pathologically hostile to all biological life except their own. The Starflyer, a prime that had escaped imprisonment, had manipulated the Commonwealth into opening the force field around Dyson Alpha, resulting in a war that killed in excess of 50 million humans. The Navy had kept an unbroken watch on the stars ever since. Centuries later, when the Rael invited the Commonwealth to join the Void Observation Project at Centurion Station, human scientists had been startled by the similarity between the planet-sized defense systems deployed throughout the wall stars and the generators that produced the Dyson pair force fields. "Until now," Troblum said, "everyone assumed the Anomine had a technology base equal to that of the Rael." He disputed that. His analysis of the Dyson pair generators showed they were almost identical in concept to the Centurion Station DF machines.
"Which proves the point, surely," Yehudi said.
"Quite the opposite," Troblum replied smoothly. The Anomine homeworld had been visited several times by the Navy's Exploration Division, as a species they had divided 2 millennia earlier. The most technologically advanced group had elevated to post-physical sentience, and the remainder had retro-evolved to a simple pastoral culture. Although they had developed wormholes and sent exploration ships ranging across the galaxy, they had settled only a dozen or so nearby star systems, none of which had massive astro-engineering facilities. The remaining pastoral societies had no knowledge of the Dyson pair generators, and the post-physicals had long since withdrawn from contact with their distant cousins. An extensive search of the sector by successive Navy ships had failed to locate the assembly structure for the Dyson pair generators. Until now, human astroarchaeologists had assumed that the abandoned machinery had decayed into the vacuum or was simply lost.
Given the colossal scale involved, Troblum said, neither was truly believable. First, however sophisticated they were, it would have taken the Anomine at least a century to build such a generator from scratch, let alone two of them.
Look how long it was taking Hyers to construct air, and that was with nearly unlimited EMAs. Second, the generators had been needed quickly. The prime aliens of Dyson Alpha already were building slower-than-light starships, which was why the Anamine sealed them in. If there had been a century gap while the Anamine beavered away at construction, the primes would have expanded out to every star within a 50-light-year radius before the generators were finished. The obvious conclusion, Troblum said, is that the Anamine simply appropriated existing Rael systems from the wall. All they would need for that would be a scaled-up wormhole generator to transport them to the Dyson pair, and we know they already possess the basic technology. What I would like is for the Navy to start a detailed search of interstellar space around the Dyson pair. The Anamine wormhole drive or drives could conceivably still be there, especially if it was a one-shot device. He gave the Admiral an expectant look. Casimir Bernelli paused as the last of Troblum's files closed. The Primes built the largest wormhole ever known in order to invade the Commonwealth across 500 light-years, he said. It was called Hell's Gateway, Troblum said automatically. You do know your history. Good. Then you should also know it was only a couple of kilometers in diameter, hardly enough to transport the barrier generators. Yes, but I'm talking about a completely new manifestation of wormhole drive technology, a wormhole that doesn't need a correspondingly large generator. You simply project the exotic matter effect to the size required. I've never heard of anything like that. It can be achieved easily within our understanding of wormhole theory, Admiral. Easily. Casimir Bernelli turned to Michaela. Captain.
I suppose it may be possible, Michaela said. I'd need to re-examine exotic matter theory before I could say one way or another.
I'm already working on a method, Troblum blurted.
Any success? Michaela queried.
Troblum suspected she was being derisive, but lacked the skill to interpret her tone. I'm progressing, yes. There's certainly no theoretical block to diameter. It's all a matter of the amount of energy available.
To ship a Dyson barrier generator halfway across the galaxy, you'd need a nova, Michaela said.
Now Troblum was sure she was mocking him. It needs nothing like that much energy, he said. In any case, if they built the generators on or near their home star, they would still have needed a transport system, wouldn't they? If they built them in situ, which is very doubtful, where is the construction site? We'd have found something that big by now. Those generators were moved from wherever the Rael had originally installed them.
Unless it was produced by their post-physicals, she said. Who knows what abilities they have or had?
Sorry, I'm going to have to go with Troblum on that one, Yoan said. We know the Anamine didn't elevate to post-physical status until after the Dyson barriers were established, approximately 150 years later. Exactly, Troblum said triumphantly. They had to be using a level of technology effectively equal to ours. Somewhere out there in interstellar space is an abandoned drive system capable of moving objects the size of planets. We need to find it, Admiral. I've already compiled a search methodology using current Navy exploration craft, which I'd like... Let me just stop you there, Casimir Bernelli said. Troblum, what you've given us so far is a very convincing hypothesis, so much so that I'm going to immediately forward your data to a senior department review committee. If they give me a positive verdict, you and I will discuss the Navy's investigation options. And believe me, for this day and age, that's being fast-tracked, okay?
But you can sanction the Exploration Division to begin the search right away. You have that authority.
I do, yes, but I don't exercise it without a good reason. What you've shown us is more than sufficient to start a serious appraisal. We will follow due process. Then, if you're right...
Of course I'm fucking right,
Troblum snapped. He knew that he was acting inappropriately, but his goal was so close. He had assumed that the Admiral's unexpected appearance that day meant the search could begin right away. I don't have the EMAs for that many starships myself. That's why the Navy has to be involved.
There would never be an opportunity for an individual to perform a search, Casimir replied lightly. Space around the Dyson pair remains restricted. This is a Navy project.
Yes, Admiral, Troblum mumbled. I understand. Which he did. But that didn't quell his resentment at the bureaucracy involved.
I notice you haven't included your results on this one-shot wormhole drive idea, Michaela said. That's a big hole in the proposal.
It's at an early stage, Troblum said, which was not quite true.
He had held back on his project precisely because he was so close to success. It was going to be the clinching argument if the presentation did not go well, which in a way it hadn't. But I hope to be giving you some positive results soon.
That I will be very interested in, Casimir said, finally producing a smile that lifted centuries away from him. Thank you for bringing this to us. And I do genuinely appreciate the effort involved.
It's what I do, Troblum said gruffly. He kept silent as the shielding switched off and the others left the chamber. What he wanted to shout after the Admiral was,
Your mother made her decisions without any committee to hold her hand, and as for what your grandfather would say about getting a consensus.
Instead, he let out a disgruntled breath as he sealed the files back into his storage lacuna. Meeting an idol was always such a risk. So few of them ever lived up to their own legends.
The delivery man was woken by his youngest daughter, just as a chilly dawn light was rising outside. Little Rosa once again had decided that 5 hours of sleep was quite sufficient for her. Now she was sitting up in her crib, wailing for attention and milk. Beside him, Lizzie was just starting to stir out of a deep sleep. Before she could wake, he swung himself out of bed and hurried along the landing to the nursery. If he wasn't quick enough, Tilly and Elsie would be woken up, and then nobody would get any peace. The pediatric housebot floated through the nursery door after him, a simple ovoid just over a meter high. It extruded Rosa's milk bulb through its neutral gray skin. Both he and his wife Lizzie hated the idea of a machine, even one as sophisticated as the housebot, caring for the child. So he settled her on his lap in the big chair at the side of the crib and started feeding her out of the bulb. Rosa smiled adoringly around the nozzle and squirmed deeper into his embrace. The housebot extended a hose that attached to the outlet patch on her sleep suit's diaper and siphoned away the night's wee. Rosa waved contentedly at the housebot as it glided out of the nursery.
Goodbye,
she cooed, and resumed drinking. Goodbye, the delivery man corrected her. At 17 months, Rosa had a vocabulary that was just starting to develop. The bionic organelles in her cells were effectively inactive, other than reproducing themselves to supplement her new cells as she grew. Extensive research had shown that it was best for a higher-born human to follow nature's original development schedule until about puberty. After that, the bionics could be used as intended. One of their functions was to modify the body however the host wanted. He still wasn't sure that was such a good idea. Handing teenagers unrestrained power over their own physiology frequently led to serious, self-inflicted blunders. He always remembered the time when he was 14 and had a terrible crush on a 17-year-old girl. He had tried to improve his genitals. It had taken 5 hugely embarrassing trips to a bionic procedure doctor to sort out the painful, abnormal growths. When Rosa finished, he carried her downstairs. He and Lizzie lived in a classic Georgian townhouse in London's Holland Park district. It had been restored 300 years before, using modern techniques to preserve as much of the old fabric as possible without having to resort to stabilizer fields. Lizzie had overseen the interior when they moved in, blending a tasteful variety of furniture and utility systems that dated from the mid-20th century right up to the 27th, when ANA's replication facilities effectively halted human design on Earth. 2 spacious sub-basements had been added, giving them an indoor swimming pool and a health spa, along with the tanks and ancillary systems that supplied the culinary cabinet and household replicator. He took Rosa into the large iron-framed conservatory where her toys were stored in big wicker baskets.
February had produced its usual icy morning outside, sending broad patterns of frost worming up the outside of the glass. For now, the only true splash of colour to enjoy in the garden came from the winter-flowering cherries on the curving bank behind the frozen fish-pond. When Lizzie came downstairs an hour later, she found him and Rosa playing with glow-blocks on the conservatory's heated flagstone floor. Tilly, who was 7, and Elsie, their 5-year-old, followed their mother in and shouted happily at their younger sister, who ran over to them with outstretched arms, babbling in her own incomprehensible yet excited language. The 3 girls started to build a tower out of the blocks. The higher they stacked, the faster the colours swirled. He gave Lizzie a quick kiss and ordered the culinary cabinet to produce some breakfast. Lizzie sat at the circular wooden table in the kitchen. An antiquities and culture specialist, she enjoyed the old-fashioned notion of a room specifically for cooking. Even though there was no need for it, she'd had a hefty iron range cooker installed when they had moved in 10 years earlier. During winter, its cosy warmth turned the kitchen into the house's engine room, and they always gathered there as a family. Sometimes she even used the range to cook things that she and the girls made out of ingredients produced by the culinary cabinet. Tilly's birthday cake had been the last. "Swimming for Tilly this morning," Lizzie said as she sipped at a big china cup of tea that a housepot delivered to her. "Again?" he asked. "She's getting a lot more confident. It's their new teacher. He's very good." "Good." The delivery man picked up the croissant on his plate and started tearing it open. "Girls," he shouted, "come and sit down, please. Bring Rosa."
"She doesn't want to come," Elsie shouted back immediately.
"Don't make me come and get you." He avoided looking at Lizzie.
"I'm going to be away for a few days."
"Anything interesting?"
"There's been allegations that some companies on Oransay have gotten hold of Level 3 replicator tech," he said. "I'll need to run tests on their products."
His current vocation was to monitor the spread of higher technology across the external worlds. It was a process the externals got very sensitive about, with hardline protectorate politicians citing it as the first act of cultural colonization deserving retribution. However, industrialists on the external worlds constantly were seeking to acquire ever more sophisticated manufacturing systems to reduce their costs. Radical hires were equally keen to supply it to them, seeing it precisely as that first important stage for a planet converting to higher culture. What he had to do on ANA governance's behalf was determine the intent behind supplying replicator systems. If radical hires were supporting the companies, he would disable the systems subtly and collapse the operation. His main problem was making an objective decision. Higher technology inevitably crept out from the central worlds in the same way that the external worlds were always settling new planets around the edge of their domain. The boundary between central and external was ambiguous, to say the least, with some external worlds openly welcoming the shift to higher status. Location was always a huge factor in his decision. Oransay was over 100 light-years out from the central worlds, which effectively negated the chance that this was simple technology seepage. If there were replicators there, it was either radicals or a very greedy company pushing them. Lizzie's eyebrows lifted. "Really? What sort of products?"
"Starship components."
"Well, that should come in handy out there right now. Very profitable, I imagine."
He appreciated her guarded amusement. The last few days had seen a rush of Starship Company officials to El Ezzelin, eager to do deals with the new cleric conservator. The girl scuttled in and settled at the table. Rosa clambered onto the 25th century suede mushroom that was her tiny tot seat. It morphed around her, gripping firmly enough to prevent her from falling out, and expanded upward to bring her level with the tabletop. She clapped her hands delightedly to be up with her family. Elsie solemnly slid a bowl of honey pops across, which Rosa grabbed.
"Don't spill it today,"
Elsie ordered imperiously.
Rosa just gurgled happily at her sister.
"Daddy, will you teleport us to school?"
Tilly asked, her voice high and pleading.
"You know I'm not going to," he told her. "Don't ask."
"Oh, please, Daddy, please."
Yes, Daddy?
Elsie chipped in. Please, teapot. I like it. Lots and lots.
I'm sure you do, but you're getting on the bus. Teleport is a serious business.
School is serious,
Tilly claimed immediately. You always say so.
Lizzie was laughing quietly. That's diff... he began. All right. I'll tell you what I'll do. If you behave yourselves while I'm gone, and only if, then I'll teleport you to school on Thursday.
Yes! Yes!
Tilly exclaimed. She was bouncing up and down on her chair. But you have to be exceptionally good, and I will find out, your mother will tell me. Both girls immediately directed huge smiles at Lizzie. Half an hour later, the bus slipped down out of the sky, a long turquoise regrav capsule that hovered just above the greenway outside the house where the road had been centuries before. The delivery man walked his daughters out to it, both of them wearing cloaks over their red blazers, the protective grey shimmer warding off the cold, damp air. He checked one last time that Tilly had her swimwear, kissed them both goodbye, and stood waving as the bus rose quickly. The whole idea of riding to school together was intended to enhance the children's sense of community, an extension of the school itself, which was little more than an organized play and activity center. Their real education would not begin until their bionics became active, but it still gave him an emotional jolt to see them vanishing into the gloomy horizon. There was only one school in London these days, south of the Thames in Dulwich Park. With a total population of barely 150,000, the city did not need another. Even for hires, the number of children was low, but then Earth's natives were notoriously reserved. The first planet to become truly higher, it had been reducing its population steadily ever since. Right at the beginning of higher culture, when bionics became available and ANA went online, the average citizen's age was already the highest in the Commonwealth. The elderly downloaded, and the younger ones who were not ready for migration to a post-physical state emigrated out to the central worlds until they chose to conclude their biological lives. The result was a small residual population with an exceptionally low birth rate. The delivery man and Lizzie were a notable exception in having three kids, but then they had registered a marriage as well, and had had a ceremony in an old church with their friends witnessing the event. A Christian priest had been brought in from an external world that still had a working religion. It was what Lizzie had wanted. She adored the old traditions and rituals. Not enough to actually get pregnant, of course. The girls had all been gestated in a womb vat. You be careful on Orense, she told him, as he examined his face in the bathroom mirror. It was, he acknowledged, rather flat, with a broad jaw, and eyes that crinkled whenever he smiled or frowned, no matter how many anti-aging techniques were applied to the surrounding skin areas, advancer or higher. His advancer genes had given his wiry, muddy red hair a luxuriant growth rate that Elsie had inherited. He had modified his facial follicles with bionics, so that he no longer had to apply shaving gel twice a day, but the process wasn't perfect. Every week he had to check his chin and dab gel on recalcitrant patches of 5 o'clock shadow. More like 5 o'clock puddles, Lizzie claimed. I always am, he assured her. He pulled on a new toga suit and waited until it had wrapped around him. Its surface haze emerged, a dark emerald shot through with silver sparkles. Rather stylish, he felt. Lizzie, who never wore any clothes designed later than the 22nd century, produced a mildly disapproving look. If it's that far from the central worlds, it's going to be deliberate. I know. I will watch out. I promise. He kissed Lizzie in reassurance, trying to ignore the guilt that was staining his thoughts like a slow poison. She studied his face, apparently satisfied with his sincerity, but that only made the lie worse. He hated these times when he couldn't tell her what he actually did. Missed a bit, she announced spryly, and tapped her forefinger on the left side of his jaw. He peered into the mirror and grunted in dismay. She was right, as always. When he was ready, the delivery man stood in the lounge, facing Lizzie, who held a squirming Rosa in her arms. He held a hand up to wave as he activated his field interface function. It immediately meshed with Earth's T-sphere, and he designated his exit coordinate. His integral force field sprang up to shield his skin. The awesome, intimidating emptiness of the translation continuum engulfed him, nullifying every sense. It was this infinite microsecond that he despised. All his bionic enrichments told him he was surrounded by nothing, not even the residual quantum signature of his own universe. With his mind starved of any sensory input, time expanded excruciatingly. Eagle's Harbor flickered into reality around him. The giant station hung 70 kilometers above southern England, one of 150 identical stations that together generated the planetary T-sphere. ANA governance had fabricated them in the shape of mythological flying saucers 3 kilometers in diameter, a level of whimsy it wasn't usually associated with. He emerged into a cavernous reception center on the station's outer rim. There were only a couple of other people using it, and they paid him no attention. In front of him, a vast, transparent hull section rose from the floor to curve away above, allowing him to look down on the entire southern half of the country. London was almost directly underneath, clad in slowly moving pockets of fog that oozed around rolling high ground like a white slick. The last time he and Lizzie had brought the kids up there had been a clear sunny day when they'd all pressed up against the hull while Lizzie pointed out historical areas and narrated the events that made them important. She had explained that the ancient city was now back down to the same physical size it had been in the mid-18th century. With the planet's population shrinking, ANA governance had ruled there were simply too many buildings left to maintain. Just because they were old didn't necessarily make them relevant. The ancient public buildings in London's centre were preserved, along with others deemed architecturally or culturally significant. But as for the sprawl of suburban housing, there were hundreds of thousands of examples of every kind from every era. Most of them were donated or sold off to various individuals and institutions across the greater Commonwealth, and those which were left were simply erased. The delivery man took a last wistful look down at the mist-draped city, feeling guilt swell to a nearly painful level. But he could never tell Lizzie what he actually did. She wanted stability for their gorgeous little family, and rightly so. Not that there was any risk involved, he told himself, as each assignment began. Really, at least not much. And if anything ever did go wrong, his faction probably could re-life him in a new body and return him home before she grew suspicious. He turned away from London and made his way across the reception center's deserted floor to one of the transit tubes opposite it. It sucked him in like an old vacuum hose, propelling him toward the center of Eagle's Haven, where the interstellar wormhole terminus was located. The scarcity of travelers surprised him. He had expected to find more hires on their inward migration to ANA. Living Dream certainly was stirring things up politically among the external worlds. The central worlds regarded the whole pilgrimage affair with their usual disdain. Even so, their political councils were worried, as demonstrated by the number of people joining them to offer their opinion. It was a fact that with Ethan's ascension to cleric conservator, the ANA factions were going to be maneuvering frantically for advantage, trying to shape the greater Commonwealth to their own visions. He couldn't work out which of them was going to benefit most from the recent election. There were so many, and their internal allegiances were all so fluid, not to mention deceitful. It was an old saying that there were as many factions as there were ex-physical humans inside ANA, and he never had encountered any convincing evidence to the contrary. That resulted in groupings that ranged from those who wanted to isolate and ignore the physical humans, some anti-animal extremists wanted them exterminated altogether, to those who sought to elevate every human, ANA or physical, to a transcendent state. The delivery man took his assignments from a broad alliance that was fundamentally conservative, following a philosophy that was keen to see things keep running along as they were, although opinions on how that should be achieved were subject to a constant and vigorous internal debate. He did it because it was a view he shared. When he eventually downloaded, in another couple of centuries or so, that would be the faction with which he would associate himself. In the meantime, he was one of its unofficial representatives to the physical Commonwealth. The station terminus was a simple spherical chamber, containing a globe 50 meters in diameter, whose surface glowed with the lambent violet of Cherenkov radiation, emanating from the exotic matter used to maintain the wormhole's stability. He slipped through the bland sheet of photons, and immediately was emerging from the exterior of a corresponding globe on St. Lincoln. The old industrial planet was still a major manufacturing base for the Central Worlds, and had maintained its status as a hub for the local wormhole network. He took a transit tube to the wormhole for Lytham, which was one of the Central Worlds farthest from Earth. Its wormhole terminus was secured at the main starport. Only the Central Worlds were linked by a long-established wormhole network. The external worlds valued their cultural and economic independence too much to be connected to the Central Worlds in such a direct fashion. With just a few exceptions, travel between them was by starship. A two-seater capsule ferried the delivery man out to the craft to which he'd been assigned. He glided between two long rows of pads where starships were parked. They ranged in size from sleek, needle-like pleasure cruisers to 100-meter passenger liners capable of flying commercial routes as far as 100 light-years. There were no cargo ships. Lytham was a higher planet and did not manufacture or import consumer items. The artful Dodger was parked toward the end of the row. It was a surprisingly squat chrome-purple ovoid, 25 meters high, standing on five tumor-like bulbs that held its wide base 3 meters off the concrete. The fuselage surface was smooth and featureless, with no hint of what lay underneath. It looked like a typical private hyperdrive ship belonging to some wealthy external world individual or company, or to a higher council with a diplomatic prerogative. An ungainly metal umbilical tower stood at the rear of the pad, with two slim hoses plugged into the ship's utility port, filling the synthesis tanks with baseline chemicals. The delivery man sent the capsule back to the rank in the reception building and walked underneath the starship. His U-Shadow called the ship's smart core and confirmed his identity, a complex process of code and DNA verification, before the smart core finally acknowledged he had the authority to take command. An airlock opened at the center of the ship's base, a dint that distended upward into a tunnel of darkness. Gravity eased off around him, and then slowly inverted, pulling him up inside. He emerged into a single midsection cabin. Inert, it was a low hemisphere of dark fabric that felt spongy to the touch. Slim ribs on the upper surface glowed a dull blue, allowing him to see. The airlock sealed below his feet. He smiled as he looked around at the blank cabin, sensing the power contained behind the bulkheads. The starship plugged into him at some animal level, circumventing all the wisdom and cool of higher behavior. He relished the power that was available, the freedom to fly across the galaxy. This was liberation in the extreme. How the girls would love to ride in it. "Give me something to sit on," he told the smart core. "Turn the lights up and activate flight control functions." An acceleration couch bloomed up from the floor as the ribs brightened, revealing a complex pattern of black lines etched on the cabin walls. The delivery man sat down. Exo-images flipped up, showing him the ship's status. His U-Shadow cleared him for flight with the spaceport governor, and he designated a flight path to Elezelin, 215 light-years away. The umbilical cables withdrew into their tower. "Let's go," he told the smart core. Compensator generators maintained level gravity inside the cabin as the artful Dodger rose on regrav. At 50 kilometers altitude, the limit of regrav, the smart core switched to ingrav, and the starship continued to accelerate away from the planet. The delivery man began to experiment with the internal layout, expanding walls and furniture out of the cabin bulkheads. The dark lines flowed and bloomed into a great variety of combinations, allowing up to 6 passengers to have tiny independent sleeping quarters that included a bathroom formation. But for all its malleability, the cabin was basically variations on a lounge. If you were traveling with anyone, he decided, let alone 5 others, you'd need to be very good friends. 1,000 kilometers above the spaceport, the artful Dodger went FTL, vanishing inside a quantum field interstice with a photonic implosion that pulled in all the stray electromagnetic radiation within a kilometer of its fuselage. There were no differences perceptible to ordinary human senses. He might have been in an underground chamber, the gravity remaining perfectly stable.
Sensors provided him with a simplified image of their course as it related to large masses back in space-time, plotting stars and planets by the way their quantum signatures affected the intersecting fields through which they were flying.
Their initial speed was a smooth 15 light-years per hour, near the limit for hyperdrive, which the sophisticated Lytham Planetary Space Watch network could track out to a couple of light-years. The delivery man waited until they were 3 light-years beyond the network and told the smart core to accelerate again. The Artful Dodger's ultra-drive pushed them up to a phenomenal 55 light-years per hour. It was enough to make the delivery man flinch. He had been on an ultra-drive ship only twice before. There were not many of them, as ANA had not released the technology to the Central Worlds. Exactly how the conservative faction had gotten hold of it was something he studiously avoided asking. 2 hours later, he reduced speed back to 15 light-years an hour and allowed the Elezalin traffic network to pick up their hyperspatial approach. He used a transdimensional, TD, channel to the planetary datasphere and requested landing permission for Riassi spaceport. Elezalin's original capital was situated on the northern coast of Sinkang, with the Kamoa River running through it. He looked down on the city as the Artful Dodger sank down toward the main spaceport. It had been laid out in a spiderweb grid with the planetary parliament at the heart. The building was still there, a grandiose structure of towers and buttresses made from an attractive mixture of ancient and modern materials. But the planet's government now was centered in Makathran II. The senior bureaucrats and their departments had moved with it, leading a migration of commerce and industry. Only the transport sector remained strong in Riassi. The wormholes that linked the planets of the Elezalin Free Trade Zone together were all here, incorporated into the spaceport, making it the most important commercial hub in the sector. The Artful Dodger landed on a pad little different from the one it had departed from barely 3 hours before. The delivery man paid a parking fee for a month in advance with an untraceable credit coin and declined an umbilical connection. His job here was finished. His U-Shadow called a taxi capsule to the pad. While he was waiting for it, the conservative faction called him. Marius has been seen on Elezalin. It was the second time that day the delivery man flinched. I suppose that was inevitable. Do you know why he's here? To support the cleric conservator. But as to the exact nature of that support, we remain uncertain. I see. Is he here in the spaceport? He asked reluctantly. He wasn't a frontline agent, but his bionics had very advanced field functions in case he stumbled into an aggressive situation. They ought to be a match for anything Marius could produce, although any aggression would be most unusual. Faction agents simply did not settle their scores physically. It wasn't done. We don't believe so. He visited the cleric conservator within an hour of the election. After that, he dropped out of sight. We are telling you simply so that you can be careful. It would not do for the accelerators to know our business any more than they want us to know theirs. Leave as quickly as possible. Understood. The taxi capsule took him over to the spaceport's massive passenger terminal. He checked in for the next United Commonwealth Starlines flight back to Akimiski, the closest central world. All the time he waited in the departure lounge, overlooking the huge central concourse, he kept his scan functions running, checking to see whether Marius was in the terminal. When the passengers boarded 40 minutes later, there had been no sign of him, or any other higher agent. The delivery man settled into his first-class compartment on the passenger ship with a considerable sense of relief. It was a hyperdrive ship that would take 15 hours to get to Akimiski. From there, he would make a quick trip to Oronse to maintain his cover. With any luck, he'd be back on Earth in less than 2 days. It would be the weekend, and they'd be able to take the girls to the Southern Sanctuary Park in New Zealand. They would enjoy that. The Rakus Bar occupied the whole third floor of a round tower in Makathran II's Abad district, just as the same building in Makathran itself had a bar on the third floor. From what he had seen in Inigo's dreams, Aaron suspected the furniture here was better, along with the lighting, not to mention the lack of the general dirt that seemed so pervasive in the original city. Rakus was patronized by a lot of visiting faithful, who perhaps were a little disappointed by how little space the nucleus of their movement took up in comparison to the prodigious metropolises of the greater Commonwealth. There was also a much better selection of drinks than the archetype boasted. Aaron presumed that was the reason ex-councillor, the Honourable Corry Lynn, kept returning there. This was the third night he had sat at a small corner table and watched her knocking back an impressive amount of alcohol at the counter. She wasn't a large woman, though at first glance her slender figure made her seem taller than she was. Ivory skin was stippled by a mass of freckles, whose highest density was in a broad swath across her eyes. Her hair was the darkest red he had ever seen. Depending on how the light caught her, it varied from shiny ebony to gold-flecked dark auburn. It was cut short, which, given how thick it was, made it curl heavily. The way it framed her dainty features made her appear like a particularly diabolic teenager. In reality, she was a 370-year-old. He knew she wasn't higher, so she must have a superb advancer metabolism, which presumably was how she could drink any bad boy under the table. For the fourth time that evening, one of the faithful, but not terribly devout, went over to try his luck. After all, the good citizens of Macathran had very healthy and active sex lives. Inigo showed that. The group of guys he was with, sitting at the big window seat, watched with sly grins and minimal sniggering as their friend claimed the empty stool beside her. Corry Lynn was not wearing her cleric robes, otherwise he never would have dared to go within 10 meters. A simple dark purple dress slit under each arm to reveal alluring amounts of skin wound up the lad's courage. She listened without comment to his opening lines, nodded reasonably when he offered to buy a drink, and beckoned the barkeeper over. Aaron wished he could go over and draw the lad away. It was painful to watch. He had seen this exact scene play out many times over the last few nights. The barkeeper came over with two heavy shot glasses and a frosted bottle of golden Adlia 88 vodka. Brewed on Vichan, it bore no real relation to original Earth vodka except for the kick. Adlia produced a liqueur that was 80% alcohol and 8% tricephalin, a powerful narcotic. The barkeeper filled both glasses and left the bottle. Corry Lynn lifted hers in salute and downed it in one shot. The hopeful lad followed suit. As he winced a smile against the burn of the icy liquid, Corry Lynn filled both glasses again. She lifted hers. Somewhat apprehensively, the lad did the same. She tossed it down straight away. There was laughter coming from the group at the window now. Their friend slugged back the drink. There were tears in his eyes. An involuntary shudder ran along his chest as if he were suppressing a cough. Corry Lynn poured them both a third shot with mechanical precision and downed hers in a single gulp. The lad gave a disgusted wave with one hand and backed away to jeering from his erstwhile pals. Aaron wasn't impressed. The previous night, one of the would-be suitors had kept up for 5 shots before retreating, hurt and confused. Corry Lynn slid the bottle back along the countertop, where the barkeeper caught it with an easy twist of his wrist and deposited it back on the shelf. She turned back to the tall beer she'd been drinking before the interruption, resting her elbows on either side of the glass, and resumed staring at nothing. Watching her, Aaron acknowledged that cultivating Corry Lynn was never going to be a subtle play of seduction. There was going to be only one chance, and if he blew that, he would have to waste days finding another angle. He got to his feet and walked over. As he approached, he could sense her Gaia field emission, which was reduced to a minimum. It was like a breath of polar air, cold enough to make him shiver. Her silhouette within the ethereal field was black, a rift into interstellar space. Most people would have hesitated at that alone, never mind the Adlia 88 humiliation. He sat on the stool the lad had vacated. She turned to give him a dismissive look, eyes running over his cheap suit with insulting apathy. Aaron called the barkeeper over and asked for a beer.
"You'll excuse me if I don't go through the ritual degradation," he said. "I'm not actually here to get inside your panties." "Thong." She took a long drink of her beer, not looking at him. "What?" That was not quite the answer he was prepared for. "Inside my thong. I suddenly feel an urge to get ordained into your religion." She grinned to herself and swirled the remains of her beer around. "You've had enough time. You've been hanging around here for a few days now." His beer arrived, and Corilyn silently swapped it for her own. Aaron raised his finger to the barkeeper. "Another. Make that two." "And it's not a religion," she said. "Of course not. How silly of me. Priest robes, worshipping a lost prophet, the promise of salvation, giving money to the city temple, going on pilgrimage. I apologize. Easy mistake to make." "Keep talking like that, off-worlder, and you'll wind up headfirst in a canal before dawn." "Headfirst or headless?" Corilyn finally turned and gave him her full attention, her smile matching her impish allure. "What in Ozzy's great universe do you want?" "To make you very rich indeed." "Why would you want to do that?" "So I can make myself even richer." "I'm not very good at bank heists." "Yeah, guess it doesn't come up much at priest school." "Priests ask you to have faith. We can take you straight to heaven. We even give you a sneak preview so you know what you're getting."
"And that's where we come in."
"We?"
"Far Flight Charters. I believe your not religion is currently in need of starships, Counselor Emeritus."
Corilyn laughed. "Oh, you are dangerous, aren't you?"
"No danger. Just an aching to be rich.
But I'm on my way to our heaven in the void. What do I need with Commonwealth money?"
"Even the Water Walker used money. But I'm not going to argue that case with you, or any other for that matter. I'm just here to make the proposition. You have contacts I need, and it is my belief you're none too happy with your old friends on the Cleric Council right now. Might be willing to bend a few ethics here and there, especially here. Am I speaking the right of things, Counselor Emeritus?"
"Why use the formal mode of address? Be bold. Go the whole way. Call me shit-listed. Everyone else does.
The Unisphere news clowns have many labels for all of us. That doesn't mean you haven't got the names I need up here." He tapped the side of his head. "And I suspect there's enough residual respect for you in Orchard Palace to open a few doors for me. Isn't that the way of it?"
"Could be. So what's your name?"
"Aaron." Corilyn smiled into her beer.
"Top of the list, huh?"
"Number one, Counselor Emeritus. So how about I buy you dinner, and you either have fun stringing me along or give me your private bank account code so I can fill it up? Take your time to decide."
"I will."
Farflight Charters was a legitimately registered company on Falnox. Anyone searching its data core would have found it brokered for several space lines and cargo couriers on 7 external planets. Not a huge operation, but profitable enough to employ 30 persons. Luckily for Aaron, it was a simple front that had been put in place should he need it. He did not know by whom. But if it had been real, his expenses would have had serious implications for this year's profitability. This was the third night he'd wined and dined Corilyn, with much emphasis on the wine. The meals had all been 5-star gourmet as well. She liked Bertrand's, in Greater Macathran, a restaurant that made the Hotel Buckingham look like a flophouse for yokels. He didn't know if she was testing his resolve. Given the state she was in most nights, she probably didn't know herself. She did dress well, though. Tonight she wore a simple little black cocktail dress whose short skirt produced a seductive hem of mist that swirled provocatively every time she crossed or uncrossed her legs. Their table was in a perfectly transparent overhanging alcove on the 72nd floor, providing an unenhanced view out across the huge nighttime city. Directly below Aaron's feet, capsules slid along their designated traffic routes in a thick glare of navigation strobes. Once he'd recovered from the creepy feeling of vertigo,
The view was quite invigorating. The 7-course meal they were eating was a sensory delight, each dish accompanied by a wine the chef had selected to complement it. The waiter had given up offering a single glass to Coriolan. Now he just left the bottle each time.
"He was a remarkable man,"
Coriolan said when she finished her gilled cherry leaf chocolate tort. She was talking about her favorite topic again. It was not difficult to get her started on Inigo. Anyone who can create a movement like Living Dream in just a couple of centuries is bound to be out of the ordinary.
No.
Coriolan waved her glass dismissively. That's not the point. If you or I had been given those dreams, there would still be Living Dream. They inspire people. Everyone can see for themselves what a beautiful, simple life can be lived in the void. One you can perfect, no matter how screwed up or stupid you are, no matter how long it takes. You can only do that inside the void. So if you promise to make that ability available to everyone, you can't not gather a whole load of followers, now can you? It's inevitable. What I'm talking about is the man himself. Mr. Incorruptible. That's rare. Give most people that much power and they'll abuse it. I would. Ethan certainly fucking does.
She poured the last of a 2.5-century-old Mithan port into an equally ancient crystal glass.
Aaron smiled tightly. The alcove to the main restaurant floor was open, and Coriolan had downed her usual amount.
That's why Inigo set up the movement hierarchy like an order of monks. Not that you couldn't have lots of sex,
she sniggered.
You just weren't supposed to take advantage of the desperate faithful. You just screw around among your own level.
So far, so pretty standard.
Of course, I wasn't very pure. We had quite a thing going, me and Inigo. Did you know that?
I do believe you mentioned it once or twice.
Of course you did. That's why you hit on me.
This isn't hitting on you, Coriolan.
Slim and fit.
She licked her lips.
That's what I am. Wouldn't you agree?
Very much so. Actually, he didn't want to admit how physically attractive she was. It helped that any sexual impulse he might have felt was effectively neutralized by her drinking. After the first hour of any evening, she was not a pleasant person to be around.
Coriolan smiled down at her dress.
Yeah, that's me, all right. So, we had this thing, this fling. I mean, sure, he saw other women.
For Ozzy's sake, the poor shit had a billion females willing and eager to rip their clothes off for him and have his babies. And I enjoyed it, too.
I mean, hell, Aaron, some of them made me look like I'd been hit hard by the ugly stick.
I thought you said he was incorruptible.
He was. He didn't take advantage, is what I'm saying. But he's human, so am I. There were distractions, that's all. The cause, the vision. He stayed true to that. He gave us the dreams of the void. He believed, Aaron. He believed utterly in what he was shown. The void really is a better place for all of us. He made me believe, too. I'd always been a loyal follower. I had faith. Then I actually met him. I saw his belief, his devotion. And through that I became a true apostle.
She finished the port and slumped back in her chair.
I'm a zealot, Aaron. A true zealot. That's why Ethan kicked me off the council. He doesn't like the old guard. Those of us who remain true. So you, mister, you just keep your snide patronizing to yourself, you bastard. I don't fucking care what you think. I hate your smart-ass weasel words. You don't believe, and that makes you evil. I bet you haven't even experienced one of the dreams. That's your mistake, because they're real. For humans, the void is heaven.
It could be heaven. You don't know for sure.
See?
She wagged a finger in his direction, barely able to focus.
You do it every time. Smart-ass words. Not stupid enough to agree with me. Oh, no, but enough to make me preach at you. Setting it up so I can save you.
You're wrong. This is all about the money.
Ha!
She held up the empty bottle of port and scowled at it. Aaron hesitated. He could never tell how much control she had. He took a risk and pushed. Anyway, if the void is salvation, why did he leave?
The result wasn't quite what he had expected. Corilyn started sobbing.
"I don't know," she wailed. "He left us. Left all of us. Ah, where are you, Inigo? Where did you go? I loved you so much."
Aaron groaned in dismay. Their quiet meal was now a full-blown public spectacle. Her sobs were increasing in volume. He hurriedly called the waiter and shuffled the seats to sit next to Corilyn, putting himself between her and the curious patrons. "Come on," he murmured. "Let's go." There was a landing platform on the 30th floor, but he wanted her to get some fresh air, so they took an elevator straight down to the skyscraper's lobby. The boulevard outside was almost deserted. A slim road running down the middle was partially hidden behind a long row of tall, bushy evergreen trees. The footpath alongside it was illuminated by slender, glowing arches.
"Do you think I'm attractive?"
Corilyn slurred as he encouraged her to walk. Past the skyscraper there were a couple of apartment blocks, all surrounded by raised gardens. Local night birds swooped and flitted silently through the arches. It was a warm air, with the smell of sea ozone accompanying the humid gusts coming in from the coast. "Very attractive," Aaron assured her. He wondered if he should insist that she take the detox aerosol he had brought along for this eventuality. The trouble with drinkers of this stature was that they didn't want to sober up that quickly, especially when they were burdened with as much grief as Corilyn was.
"Then how come you don't want me? Is it the drink? Do you not like me drinking?"
She broke away to look at him, swaying slightly, her eyes blurred from tears, hauntingly miserable. With her light coat undone to show off the exclusive cocktail dress, she presented a profoundly unappealing sight. "Business before pleasure," Aaron said, hoping she would accept that and shut the hell up. He should have caught a taxi from the skyscraper's platform. As if she finally were picking up on his exasperation, she turned fast and started walking. Someone appeared on the path barely 5 meters in front of them, a man in a one-piece suit that still had the remnants of its black stealth envelope swirling like water in low gravity. Aaron scanned around with his full field functions. Two more people were shedding their envelopes as they walked up behind him. His combat routines moved smoothly to active status, accessing the situation. They designated the first of the group to confront them. 1. 80% probability he was the commander. The subordinates were tagged 2 and 3. His close-range situation exo-image showed all three of them glowing with enrichments. He actually relaxed. By confronting him, they had taken away all choice. With that accepted, there could only be one outcome now. He simply waited for them to present him with the maximum target opportunity. Corilyn blinked in mild bewilderment, peering forward at the first man as she clutched her small scarlet bag to her belly.
"I didn't see you. Where were you?"
"You don't look too good, Your Honor," one replied. "Why don't you come along with us?"
Corilyn pressed back into Aaron's side, degrading his strike ability by a third. "No," she moaned. "No, I don't want to."
"You're bringing the living dream into disrepute, Your Honor," Juan said. "Is that what Inigo would have wanted?"
"I know you," she said wretchedly. "I'm not going with you. Aaron, don't leave me, please."
"Nobody is going anywhere they don't want to." Juan did not even look at him. "You, fuck off. If you ever want a sales meeting with a counselor, be smart now." "Ah, well now, here's the thing," Aaron said affably. "I'm so stupid, I can't afford an IQ boost come regeneration time, so I just stay this way forever." Behind him, 2 and 3 were standing very close. They both drew small pistols. Aaron's routines identified their hardware as jelly guns, which had been developed a century and a half earlier as a lethal short-range weapon that acted exactly as specified on human flesh. He could feel accelerants slipping through his neurons, quickening his mental reaction time. Bionic energy currents synchronized with them, upgrading his physical responses to match. The effect dragged out spoken words, so much so that he easily could predict what was going to be said long before Juan finished his sentence. "Then I'm sorry for you." Juan sent a fast message to his subordinates that Aaron intercepted.
It was nothing more than a simple code. He did not even need to decrypt it. Both of them raised their weapons. Aaron's combat routines already were moving him smoothly. He twisted Corilin out of the way as he bent down. The first shot from Two's jelly gun seared through the air where Aaron's head had been less than a second before. The beam struck the wall, producing a squirt of concrete dust. Aaron's foot came up fast, smashing into the knee of Three. Their force fields clashed with a screech, electrons flaring in a rosette of blue-white light. The velocity and power behind Aaron's kick were enough to distort his opponent's protection. Three's leg shattered as it was punched backward, throwing his whole body sideways. Aaron's energy currents formatted a distortion pulse that slammed into one. He was flung back 6 meters into the garden wall, hitting it with a dull thud. His straining force field pushed out a dangerous bruised purple nimbus as another of Aaron's distorter pulses pummeled him, trying to shove him through the wall. His back arched at the impact, his force field close to outright failure. Two was trying to swing his pistol around, tracking a target that was moving with inhuman speed. All his enriched senses revealed was a blurred shape as Aaron danced across the path. He never got a lock. Aaron's hand materialized out of a dim streak to chop across his throat, overloading the force field. His neck snapped instantly, and his corpse flew through the air. Aaron snatched the jelly gun from Two's hand at the same time, wrenching the fingers off with a liquid crunching sound. It took Aaron a fraction of a second to spin around again. His force field expanded into the ground, an anchor snatching away inertia, allowing him to stop instantly, the pistol aligned on one, as the dazed man was clambering unsteadily to his feet. Blood from the severed fingers dripped down onto the path. One froze, sucking down air as he stared at the nozzle of the jelly gun. Aaron opened his grip, allowing the fingers to slither away. "Who are they?" he yelled at Corilin, who was lying on the sodden grass where she'd landed. She was giving one a bewildered look. "Who?" Aaron demanded.
The police. That's Captain Manby, Special Protection Division."
"That's right," Manby wheezed, as he flinched against the pain. "So you just put that fucking gun down. You're already drowning in shit so deep that you'll never see the universe again.
Join me at the bottom." Aaron pressed the trigger on the jelly gun, holding it down on continuous fire mode. He added his own distortion pulse to the barrage. Manby's force field held out for almost 2 seconds before collapsing. The jelly gun pulses struck the exposed body. Aaron turned and fired again, overloading Three's force field. Corilin threw up as waves of bloody sludge from both ruined corpses cascaded across the ground. She was wailing like a wounded kitten when Aaron hauled her to her feet. "We have to go," he shouted at her. She shrank back from his hold. "Come on, now, move!" His U-shadow already was calling down a taxi.
"No," she whimpered. "No, no, they didn't. You just killed them. You killed them."
"Do you understand what this is?" he growled at her,
his voice loud and aggressive. He was using belligerence to keep her off balance.
"Do you understand what just happened? Do you? They're an assassination squad. Ethan wants you dead. Permanently dead."
"You can't stay here. They'll keep coming after you, Corilin. I can protect you."
"Me?" she sobbed. "They wanted me."
"Yes. Now come on. We're not safe here."
"Oh, sweet Ozzy."
He shook her. "Do you understand?"
"Yes,"
she whispered. By the way she was shaking, Aaron thought she was going into mild shock.
"Good."
He started to walk toward the descending taxi, hauling her along, heedless of the way she stumbled to keep up. It was hard not to smile. He could not have delivered a better result to the evening if he had planned it.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.